House Committee on Revenue for June 27, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, I note the date, and that becomes an issue. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2064. Mazen, come and tell us where we are in this bill, and then we'll have a chat about it and see whether we can move it today or whether we need to hold off until another day to discuss it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is House Bill 2064, the last House bill in the House Committee. And you have a number of amendments that we've talked about with time.
And where are we parliamentarily?
Parliamentary, last time we have adopted a dash 9 into the bill. However, that we didn't go forward with the bill, meaning it wasn't voted out of committee or anything.
Right.
So we have to have, if you need to change anything now, the dash 9 somehow needs to come out.
Right. Okay. Colleagues, this is the bill having to do with the transient lodging tax, and we're talking primarily at this stage about the collection process. There's been a lot of work behind the scenes on this measure, and we're now looking at the possibility of replacing the dash 9 amendment with the dash 8 amendment, which actually is more likely to get us to the result that that we need. Would you describe what the dash 8 amendment does?
And the dash 8, Mr. Chair, as we have here, it primarily talks about clarifying the changes in the definition of intermediary. That allows it to include collection and consideration, providing the use of a third party. So that model becomes part of the definition, which allows for the collection from them, and also establishes the joint liability for the tax delinquencies too. So it is primarily becomes a way of improving the definitions for the purpose of the collections of both Department of Revenue and the local government.
And colleagues, you'll recall that that was one of the issues that we were dealing with in when we were looking at this bill. We were also looking at another section which is not in this amendment, having to do with changes to the ways in which the people who have assessed a transient lodging tax could spend the money. I wonder if we could hear from the cities and from Orla to talk a little bit about the Dash 8 and where you sit on the current posture of the bill. And I'd like you to address the Dash 8 Amendment, your views of it, and also from Orla, the same question.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The Dash 8 amendments are limited to addressing only the issue of intermediaries. In the 2013 session, the legislature also addressed intermediaries to make sure that all entities would pay the tax, the state tax and the local tax. Since that time, in 2013, the business model, if you will, of some intermediaries has changed, and in addition, it has sort of come out through litigation and such that the language doesn't match the state language for collecting the tax, filing the tax returns, and paying the tax. And so, for intermediaries, and so this bill does two things. Or with the dash eights, it changes the definition of intermediaries to include the different types. Better, and then it also adds a section 8, a new section of law, to make sure that the provider or the intermediary is paying the tax and filing the returns and collecting the tax. And then it makes a similar tweak to the state tax as well to make sure those new definitions are applied. And so there's not a double taxation. The last hearing, we talked about that problem of if we get all the intermediaries listed correctly, then we don't want them both to be taxed, the hotelier and the intermediary. And so we fixed that by how we've adjusted this amendment. So only the one that has that connection to the consideration, the money for the room, would pay the tax. So that's what the amendment would do. And the League of Oregon Cities supports this amendment, as does the Association of Oregon Counties. Basically, what's happening is we're not being paid the tax in many of our cities and counties, depending on the business model. Some aren't being paid at all by some vendors, and some are being paid in some cities and counties by agreement. This would treat them all the same and require them all to pay the tax.
Thank you. And do you think that this amendment deals with the litigation issues that you've mentioned?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, yes. The litigation issues have been about who's responsible, and this would clarify it. It's been reviewed by our cities and counties, and they all support the amendment as it's written.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 4, line 19 through 22, it talks about joint and several for responsibility on taxes. Was there any consideration that this is going to discourage investment by minority investors in projects?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, this was substantially narrowed to deal with just the state piece. So this is the state. They're dealing with this issue of who's responsible with a homeowner with multiple homes. And so that was done to fix that issue. But no, I'm not aware of any minority issues or concerns about investment at all.
Let me read this out loud. If the transient lodging is owned by more than one person, each and every owner may be held jointly and severally liable for any tax imposed under da-da-da-da-da. And so you could have a minority owner who only has 1-2%, who had no management responsibility but simply threw bucks in to help with the down payment, and now they're held to the same standard of liability as the person who's managing it and may have a 80% ownership interest.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, I would leave that to the Department of Revenue to answer, but I think the real issue is this is only used for enforcement. Most of our providers are paying the tax, but the question is, well, who is the responsible party? And it hasn't been clear in the law until now.
Mr. Chair, I don't know much about anything, but I do know the definition of joint and several as it relates to liability. And that basically says if you're an owner, you're now held 100%. Doesn't matter what your interest in the property is.
That's correct.
I'd be troubled by that. But okay. Thank you.
For the record, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association, and I know Representative Marsh held a work group on the Dash 8 specifically, and so some of the issues we had in the pre-2049, I think was the other bill, were addressed there in the, so yeah, our issue really is we wanted to make sure that the League of Oregon Cities and the Department of Revenue were equal in the enforcement of trying to make sure to collect the tax, and I've heard from both of them that that's where they're at, and we really just want to make sure that whether you're renting a house or a room in a house or a motel room, everybody gets treated the same. That's we're really looking for a uniform policy. Under 2049, to the joint and several liability issue, excuse me, if you remember back in the other bill we dealt with, what we were concerned with, and I think the 2049 wasn't as clear, was if you pay to Expedia Travelocity that you couldn't go back after the hotel owner even though they didn't collect the money. And so my understanding is the collectors needed something to where the people that are collecting the money, if there's joint ownership, all of them hold some responsibility. So we just need to make sure that those two specific issues were separated, and my understanding is the Dash 8s do that, so from our perspective.
All right. So if the owner properly handles the collection and remitting of the tax, then this joint and several issue just simply isn't a problem.
That's my understanding.
All right. Correct. Thank you. Does the department want to be heard on that question? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate the clarification.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Xan Culver with the Department of Revenue. In regards to the joint and several liability question, we see it as a collection tool, primarily in the instances of vacation homes where there's multiple vacation home owners for the same property, and they divide up usage of the home. One person rents it out. Others don't know that that's happening. If the one entity that's renting it out isn't collecting and remitting the tax, we do want all owners to be responsible for the tax on that property. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the state lodging tax.
And the effect of that, of course, would be the first time you go after an owner who didn't receive the rent money, their agreement with the people who do receive the rent money would change, wouldn't it?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, no disagreement with what you're sharing. If I was with the state, I would do this as well if I wanted maximum collection. What my comment is based on is it going to discourage investment in projects? Because, again, if I'm a minority owner but I'm held 100% liable, I'm out. That's too big of a risk for me.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Anything else today? Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2064. And open a work session on Senate Bill 181. Who's on that one? Oh, Kyle. Kyle, we've been working this thing furiously, and you've been getting drafted a whole bunch of amendments. I think my office has had some others drafted. Colleagues, if you'll recall, this bill is one of those bills that had to do with a requirement that nonprofits or that those seeking property tax exemptions in certain categories have to file with the tax assessor reports on an annual basis, and you know through all the details. The key issue that seemed to come up on the floor over and over again, at least in the conversations that I had to do with the process when it didn't happen the way it was supposed to, or when the information was incomplete. So we prepared a whole series of amendments culminating in the -9, which I think we got just this morning. So I'd like very much, Kyle, if you would go through the -9 amendment to talk about how that works, and then I would like to hear from the tax assessors. He is right in the front row. Yeah, good. Kyle, do you want to tell us about it?
Okay, Mr. Chair, 181 with the -A9, so I'll just note, we do have the AA up there, but that's an older version. I just didn't want to remove it from all this, so that's why it's really still up there. But so the -A9, I draw your attention to, in the meeting materials, there's an overview of Senate Bill 181 with the -A9, and this starts with the same structure that you saw for just Senate Bill 181 as the A engrossed. Reiterate or refresh the committee on the underlying bill, you can see the institutions that are required to file. So these are ones that are claiming exemption under ORS 307-130, the Literary, Charitable, and Scientific Organization Institution Exemption, Property Tax Exemption. And there are certain institutions that are not required to file that information. So those are the ones that are in the bulleted points up at the top of this overview. So those listed institutions are not required to file. And they already have requirements within the statute, and that's part of the reason they're not included in this new information return. What's on the information return remains unchanged. So that's in the box that you see up on the screen there, the organization reporting, the property-specific reporting. That's unchanged in the A9. So the change, the first of the, really the three changes, the first one is relating to what's labeled as the clawback. And this has to do, if a nonprofit institution is submitting an information return and they submit something that on the information return that is misleading or false, as determined by the assessor. So if a nonprofit institution sends that return in and the assessor finds something that they feel is misleading or false, and that would, one of the new changes added in the A9, and that materially affects the exemption qualification for the property, and the idea here is to avoid misspellings or some of those smaller issues or something to that effect. So if it's going to actually hinge, if the exemption determination is going to hinge on something that's in this information return that the assessor thinks is misleading or false, they will notify the nonprofit institution that sent in the information return of the concerns, and the assessors are required to identify what their concerns are, what they think is misleading or false. There's then a third 30-day window for the nonprofit institution to send in an amended information return addressing the assessor's concerns. Now, if that process, if they address the assessor's concerns, everything moves forward as normal, exemption would apply. If they do not, that's where the exemption, the property would be disqualified, and there's the clawback, so the potential clawback up to 5 years. And this is really about an information return that's misleading or false. So errors will be corrected if an institution simply does not send in their nonprofit information return. There's no clawback. It's just a normal, then they just wouldn't qualify for the exemption going forward. So it really is about that information return having something misleading or false. So those are the changes, that notification of the assessor requirements and such is contained. That's in the new A9. There was language added specifically showing that the nonprofit institution has appeal rights to the Oregon Tax Court for something, a decision of the assessor relating to that misleading or false. So that was... that's going to be in the language already, but we wanted to make that explicit. There was some concern that that may not be as straightforward as it could be, so that was explicitly included in the dash A9 amendment. And then another change that was added is a requirement for Legislative Revenue Office to study the information returns and report back to the Interim Revenue Committees no later than September 15th, 2019. So this will give the Legislative Revenue Office time to see definitely 1 year worth of information returns and potentially at least a partial second year, because there is an ability for nonprofits to late file up until December, even the following April. But so we'll have about 2 years worth of information returns that the office will then report back to the interim committees on. So that's a new change in the A9. And then the last change is a pretty small one, actually. It's just tying, truing up. There was a date in there about the initial late filing information return that's available with a late fee of $200 or the greater of 0.1% of the real market value of the property. But we had it in there, the language originally was saying December 15th, but the standard late fee or the late filing deadline would be 12/31. So that language has been trued up to the more standard language. So a nonprofit institution would have until December 31st to file an information return with a late filing. And there are provisions even file that following April as well, if they can demonstrate good cause to the assessor. So those are, I guess, the four changes contained in the A9.
Okay, thank you. Was there any change made to the $200 late filing assessment other than the date?
No, Mr. Chair, with the date was the change. There is a tie in the A engrossed version to, I think it's 307.162 sub 2, that is the late filing requirements already in statute, which have that 12/31 date following April date, and the $200 late fee is already in there. So it almost is perhaps duplicative of the 12/31 initial year, because that's already contained in statute.
So is it, now does that only apply to the initial year, or does it apply to other years as well?
It would be each year. So it's an annual filing, information filing return. So it's, if you file late in 2 years in a row, you have to pay $200 in each year.
Right.
But you, nonprofit would have the option to late file each year if something came up or something like that.
Thank you. Colleagues, questions for Kyle? Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, on the clawback provision, so this ability, I guess, is in the hands of the county assessor. Is that correct? To enact that process? And I'm guessing it says it can be up to the 5 immediate preceding tax years. So is the measure... lay out any criteria for what would determine whether it's a 1 year or 5 year clawback?
Yes, Representative. It's up to 5 years. So if a property was qualifying for the previous two,
been out for the past.
Yeah. So it depends upon the number of years. It's up to the 5 years. But if they've only been exempt for maybe 1 year, it'd be a 1 year clawback because that's all that's available, and it's the amount that has been exempt in the past. Those property tax dollars that would have otherwise been due. That's the amount of the clawback plus delinquent interest there.
But it's permissive on the part of the county assessor, correct? It's not a requirement?
Yes, so the assessor is only required, they're required to notify the nonprofit if it's going to materially affect. So if the assessor, if it's something small or something, you know, that's not going to change the assessor's mind on whether it qualifies or not, they are not required in that case to contact the nonprofit. But if it is something in the information return that will determine how the assessor qualifies the property, yay or nay, then they are required in that instance to notify the nonprofit, and the nonprofit has the opportunity to correct, if you will, what the assessor has identified as misleading or false.
Thank you. Any other questions for, yes, Representative Bueller, please.
Thanks, Chair Barnhart. Can you outline the rationale for the exemptions that are included here? The institutions that are exempted from filing?
Yes, Representative Bueller. So that was in part just reflective of, so if we're scrolling, yeah, up at the top there, the requirements, the museums had requirements put in place, I think it was either 2016 or in 2015 in the exemption. So there's some other parameters within the 307-130 statute that have to be met by those specific institutions, retail stores and such. So I guess the policy decision there was, since there's already some things in place now existing for these types of institutions within the statute, there wasn't sufficient need to require them to do the information return.
Yep, please.
And what added information do we expect to receive beyond what is already reported and required with the Form 990?
Yeah, Representative, if we scroll down just a bit on the overview, I guess a couple of the boxes there that are is information that is not contained necessarily in the 990. One is on the organization reporting level, and the other is on the property-specific level. So if we just go a little bit up further to the top there. So under the organization reporting, the box, I guess it'd be the third box down, in that column. So the ways in which the organization's performance involves a gift or giving, and the quantification of the gift or giving as a percentage of the organization's total expenses as reported on the IRS Form 990. So the expenses there are from the 990, but the percentage that's a gift or giving is that would be a figure that you couldn't necessarily just pull off of the 990. That would take information reported directly from the nonprofit. So that's not something, there's not two lines on the 990 right now that contain that information. So that'd be one thing that's new. And then the number of days in the previous property tax year, that'd be something, and this is the third box under the property specific reporting in that overview. That would be another requirement of the information return that's not included on the 990 return today.
Yeah, unfortunately, none of the members of the work group happen to be here today. One of them's no longer on the committee, and the other's working busily on transportation. And of course, the issue was gathering data sufficient to allow us to actually reform the statutes that apply to property tax exemptions in this area. I think it's fair to say that the work group was stymied trying to get the data necessary to make these determinations. This law is an old one. It's been around for a long time. It's been tinkered with around the edges, but nobody's actually collected the data to be able to understand how the thing actually works. And of course, this bill has the added benefit that if there are fly-by-nights out there who have been flying under the radar, if they file truthful statements with the assessors, will end up paying a property tax on property that should not have been exempted. I don't know that that's going to be a big deal, but it's certainly something. It may have the effect, too, of reducing the number of contributions from people who think they're contributing to a charity when they're really not. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still trying to get my arms around the legislation.
Well, that's one of the reasons I just thought we'd talk today and then actually vote on it later.
So let me ask this question. So if we have a nonprofit that has operations or assets in multiple counties, will they then be obligated to report to each individual county?
Yes, Representative Smith, yeah. And that's the way the exemption's structured now. When you initially apply for the exemption, it's in the county in which the property resides.
So I just want to be real clear. So let's say we had a little nonprofit in Umatilla County that did nonprofit lending and had loans in 10 Eastern Oregon counties and assets spread out, but only a staff of one person, they're gonna be taking on a little bit of extra workload there to make sure that they're reporting in each one of those 10 counties.
With the loans?
With
the property that the loan applies to be?
Well, if it's secured or if they've had to take it back or if they have economic interest in those counties.
Yeah, but would those properties be tax exempt?
No, but they could become assets of the nonprofit. Let's just say I made a loan to XYZ company in Mountaineer County, and the loan goes into default and now becomes the property of the nonprofit and is held in the county until it's sold. That becomes an asset of the nonprofit, and they would now have to report that.
Well, only if they're asking for a property tax exemption. If the property is not tax exempt, then there's not an issue.
Okay, thank you.
Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm assuming wouldn't they want to ask for that exemption?
Well, Kyle, would you describe briefly the use the rule involving how you get property to be tax exempt for this purpose?
Or I could even be more clear. Here's a more clear example.
Yeah.
If I'm OPB and I've got radio towers or TV towers in multiple counties throughout the state, mm-hmm. am I now going to have to take that added responsibility on to notify each county assessor on an annual basis about those assets?
So Representative Smith, without, I guess in a general term, it's going to be dependent upon whether the property is exempt to begin with. So that's really the first test. And that's one of the key things, because to be exempt under current law today, it's not only the organization, but it's also the use of the property. So the organization could be an exempt type organization. It's a 501c3 or something to that effect. But it's how the property is also used that determines the exemption. So if the property right now is used in a way that meets the charitable requirements of the statute, then it's exempt in the multiple counties. There's certainly no guarantee depending on how the property is being used. So if it's owned in different counties and it's subleased to another entity, at that time the exemption is dependent upon what that other entity is. So if it's a commercial for-profit entity, it's no longer exempt at that time. If it's another nonprofit institution, then it can be. There's other statute requirements to apply for that exemption.
Let me ask just one follow-up, and then I'll let this go. Do we anticipate that the Department of Revenue or some other entity is going to provide training to all these little nonprofits to help them understand what the requirement is versus what is not the requirement?
Could we hear from the assessors on this and the previous question?
I have a question, too.
I think it's good. I note that the assessor is going to be required to send a notice. One assumes that early on that notice is going to have to be pretty explicit about what it is that you're asking for.
And I'm done asking questions. I just curious.
Right.
Thank you.
Assuming this bill goes into effect, let me see if I can translate. And Representative Smith, if I get it wrong, you tell me. My assumption is that a bunch of nonprofits are going to have to do a little work the first year in order to fill out these forms and get them into the assessor. And if their use of the property doesn't change in future years, they're going to Xerox the original answers, change the date on it, and send it in. Is that what the assessor is expecting for the future? Now, if the use of the property changes, then they'll have to do something different.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I'm representing the Assessors Association. That would be probably the most reasonable thing that would happen for most of these nonprofits. I think their purpose and what they do would stay consistent from year to year. And once they've filled the form out the first year, whether they photocopy it or they actually rewrite it onto another one, they wouldn't have to probably think about the answer and come up with an answer, because that would have been done in the first year. And a lot of the processing work that we're going to have to do to set this up would be done in the first year also. a question that Representative Smith had on a lending institution that had acquired a property. I'm not sure first that the lending institution would qualify under a 307-130, but if it did and they acquired a piece of property, it goes back to what Kyle said. It's the use of the property along with who owns it. So if they acquire a retail store and that retail store is not doing charitable work, then it would be taxable. And that's the same thing that we do now. Mm-hmm. We have cities, we have organizations that acquire property through whatever reason, and if they are not using it according to the purpose of their organization, then it's taxable.
Okay. Representative Nose, did you have something?
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I think maybe my question is a little more basic. So I understood that if a nonprofit, say like a museum, operates a for-profit gift store or a for-profit coffee shop because patrons want to have coffee, but they're plowing the profits of that thing back into the nonprofit's tax status. It's either supporting salaries of, you know, administrative assistants or the director or whatever. That seems like that's part of the chair. That wouldn't be taxed, right? Because that's a for-profit part that's underpinning part of the charitable operation. Now, I realize it gets kind of gray. Like, I remember there was an issue with, it was in McMinnville.
Evergreen.
Where they were running an amusement park, you know, with a slip and slide, not really having anything to do with the Spruce Goose or airplanes, right, but just an outright amusement park on a nonprofit. That, to me, seems like that crosses the line versus having a gift shop, you know, or
or
in the case of OPB, the occasional leasing.
I'm going to let him answer your question, but I'll note that it's really not germane to this bill, because now you're getting into the question of what's a tax exempt and what isn't.
Yeah.
This bill is about reporting.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart.
The point I'm trying to get at.
If you want to answer that, please go ahead.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'll try and answer it. I was trying to think back on the Evergreen decision or the statute. There is a provision for what's called destination of income, and the courts have said that you could have an organization that has a money-making side of it, but you can't look at the destination of income to qualify that money-making organization, even though it was owned by the nonprofit. But to your question specifically of coffee shops and bookstores and things like that, I think we'd look at the primary use of that property. If the gift shop and the coffee shop was a subsidiary thing that just provided some service to the people coming, we probably wouldn't, depending on the size and the scope of it, we probably would not create a taxable entity for that coffee shop portion. I know that there have been some that we've created that for, but it's probably on a very limited basis.
Mr. Chair, yep, I can follow up, please. Uh-huh. So this gets to the question I would have about OPB. Mm-hmm. If on occasion they lease a tower to a for-profit, right, they don't need it, you know, they're giving it to somebody else to use, I assume occasionally then they're plowing that back into their nonprofit mission, but yes, they made a profit or they leased it to somebody that's for-profit. Does that then slip them over into a for-profit entity when they're only doing it occasionally and they're plowing whatever revenue is made back into the charitable mission of Oregon Public Broadcasting?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, there's a lot of speculation here. Would this be on an annual basis or would this just be on a spot basis? You know,
if it's on an
annual basis, then it would probably be taxable. Okay, if it is just a spot lease where they needed to get something out, it might not be taxable.
Okay.
And again, I don't know that I have any of those situations in Polk County, so I can't tell you specifically how we handle them. It is an issue, but it is, to me, it's nothing different than any other nonprofit leasing to a for-profit corporation. That is then taxable. Now, it has to be taxable at certain times during the year. They could lease that on July 5th to a taxable entity, and it would be non-taxable the whole fiscal year. because it has to be in the it has to be in the taxable ownership and possession as of July 1st. So
different set of laws not related to
yeah,
this bill.
It just gets my head, it gets okay. It gets very convoluted.
Right. I think one of the issues and concerns about OPB was the idea that they have facilities in every county and it's be a lot of work for them. I think the point I was trying to make a minute ago was that, yeah, it would be, it is going to be a fair amount of work the first year. Assuming the uses don't change after that, it's not going to be a lot of work.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, yes, I believe that's true. I don't know the structure of OPB and how they handle their right. rents on their towers for broadcasting and things like that. So,
right. And I don't think anyone else here does either.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Representative Bueller and then Representative Marsh.
Yeah, I think Chair Barnhart. So maybe I'm a little slow in the uptake here, but exactly what problem are we hoping to solve with this?
I think I described earlier that the point of doing this was to get a systemic understanding of how this statute's actually working, what people are using it, what they're using it for, partly so that the assessor will have the tools needed to make the determination as to whether a piece of property is being used for a purpose that ought not to be taxed for property taxes, and secondarily so that the committee and the legislature have a better capacity with additional information to reform this statute, with this very vague, very general statute that we've been living under for a long time.
So just to follow up to that, so then either one of you, so we don't believe that the 990 provides enough information to make that determination.
Yeah, that's correct.
It's a pretty extensive document.
Yes, it is, and of course Kyle described some of the ways in which it is not sufficient for our purposes. Representative Marsh?
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow up on that, what I remember when Senators Boquist and Riley came over and presented for the work group, which had been apparently working for 18 months as it was described.
Yeah, long time, yeah.
I also addressed the fact that many of our decisions around this really are determined in court at this moment, and
yep.
the desire to get out of the court and to really set up, by collecting information, those bright lines that will be able to provide assessors and nonprofits with clarity about their appropriateness for an exemption. But I have a question for you.
Please.
Thanks for, we haven't seen you in such a long time.
Yeah, it's been a couple weeks.
Yeah.
We're missing the opportunity, right.
So one of the amendments that's been added since we last talked about this was a requirement for a report back on how the program is working in a couple of years. I think it's possible if we do this for a couple of years, get some data, get the data that we're yearning for, put it together, that it will be possible for us to provide assessors with additional clarity that may allow us to cut back on some of these annual reports?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, that is kind of how I see it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the first few years, whether it's 5 years or whatever, I think it will be an annual reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we can gather enough information for the legislature to analyze what types of organizations are in this general statute and what they're doing, there may be a couple things that need to be done. We may need to break the 307-130 apart into multiple statutes with different qualifying criteria based on the organization that they are. And then at that point, the legislature could choose to not gather information anymore, or they could do it on a spot basis once every 3 years, 5 years, to try and validate. But that would be up to them at that point, depending on the data that is gathered. And I think if the assessors see that this has gathered good information, we might even come back and say, maybe we need to spread this out into a, not every year, but every few years, if we're getting good data.
Right.
That would reduce your workload as well, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Bueller?
Chair Barnhart, so am I correct in assuming that you can't request this information directly under existing law from concerning nonprofits?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, we can request this information, and we have at times in the past. This is again a data gathering tool on a statewide basis. So individual assessors can ask this information, maybe even more if we want, in order to support that exemption request. But we don't have the mechanism, and the legislature doesn't have the mechanism to determine if how the one organization is operating is a good indication of what's going on around the state. Plus, even if they reported that information to us, we don't know if the amount of charity that they're doing is sufficient for what the legislature intended in order to grant the exemption.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Colleagues, again, I want to give you another day to look at this and consider it. There are some associations that have had interest in it. My understanding is that the nonprofit association that we've heard from is okay with this, but I'm not going to assert that finally until I've had a chance to check it for certain, and I haven't been able to do that as yet.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, please. I'd like to address just one question that Representative Johnson raised on the that the ability to disqualify for 5 years back is permissive to the assessor. That is correct. It is. We have that same ability on some other programs too, like Farm and Forest. We can go back 5 and 10 years if they're not using it. The provision where that's used is only if we believe that they have gained that exemption through false or misleading information. It's not just that they didn't report something correctly. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is permissive, and they also, if they believe that we've implemented that or taken that away, they can't appeal that and present their information to the court, and the court could say, no, we overreacted. So it is permissive, but I know I don't take that lightly because that is a large penalty, and it is only if we believe that they have gained that through false information.
Yeah, and let me clarify what I think the question is in addition to that. Suppose that the nonprofit has been using the property for an exempt purpose until 2 years ago. You couldn't go back 5 years then, could you, at that point?
You could only
go back 2 years.
Only the amount of years that they had been using the facility, and only if we felt that it was through misleading and false information. If they just didn't file something that we needed, then we would disqualify it for that year and move forward. So they would only lose that for that year, just like now. If they don't provide correct information to us, we cannot grant that for the current year. That's no change from what we do now.
I think the five-year rule basically is to say you can't go back any further than that. Somebody, a fly-by-night comes in, they have a piece of property, they lie about what they're using it for, and 15 years later you catch them at it, you can still only go back 5 years.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, that is correct. And that is the same with other statutes. We can only go back as long as what the statute says, 5 or 10 years.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Colleagues, we're going to close this work session on Senate Bill 181. We're not going to work Senate Bill 845 today. Please read the conflict amendment that's been proposed. It's simply an amendment to deal with matters that were dealt with in a different bill. We'll talk about that later. I do expect to meet tomorrow. I'm not certain of the time at this moment. And with that, the committee is adjourned.